You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me.
Welcome back, everybody. We're here reading Contributions to Philosophy of the Event. I sense we're on section 91.
Yes.
Last episode you said maybe you weren't pregnant?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't even remember. I think that was two episodes ago.
No, well, I think last episode you were like, your numbers are bad.
Oh, do we... Yeah, you're right. We found out Tuesday. Okay, so yeah. Tuesday we found out that it's looking promising, but still very confusing.
Yes.
Because we are outpatient monitoring, so the clinics have a very hard time communicating.
Yep.
So right now my HCG is like 50,000, or on Tuesday, which is apparently like my clinic in New Jersey says that's literally impossible.
Yeah.
But the clinic in Arizona is like, that's the number. That's what our lab says. We've double checked. That's the number. Don't call us again. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. I forgot. Yeah, so definitely. I mean, but the good thing is there is a gestational sac.
And a yolk.
The yolk is a little questionable, but
so a lot of
we
people
think
probably
so.
A lot of people probably don't know that human babies have yolks.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't know that until you said it. I never realized.
Yeah, like a chicken.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, so I think the yolk sac is the first thing that develops.
Yolk sac, yeah.
The first thing that develops that like the ultrasound can see outside of the gestational sac or inside the gestational sac, I should say. Like it's the first visible structure inside.
Yeah.
And then I think the embryo is actually like inside that, maybe. I don't know, actually.
Yeah.
But just the fact that they can see it is a good sign. It means the pregnancy is not ectopic, which was one of the concerns. And I think they're just very confused about my HCG. So they're just...
All right. I hope they get it figured out.
Yeah.
Great. Congratulations. I think you're more pregnant than you were last time.
I think so, too. Yeah. I think so too. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good.
Wow, I forgot. That's crazy and, you know, that Monday night.
My best to the father. Monday night? Oh.
No, the last time we recorded, we didn't know that. It was like we were going to find out the next day.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Fun. So, in the spirit of life, we read Heidegger. Section 91, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm ready to go when you are.
From the first beginning, I'll start over. 91. From the first to the other beginning. The first beginning experiences and posits the truth of beings without asking about truth as such. For the things unconcealed in the truth of beings, namely beings as beings, necessarily overpower everything because they swallow up even nothingness, incorporating it as the not and the over and against, or else they utterly annihilate it.
Yeah. Should I talk about that?
Sure.
The first beginning, again, the beginning of metaphysics as outlaid by the great Greeks, experiences and posits the truth of beings. So it talks about truth as a thing inherent in beings, yet doesn't ask about truth as such, doesn't ask really what truth is, or how beings can have truth. For the things unconcealed in the truth of beings, namely beings as beings, necessarily overpower everything. So the things unconcealed in the truth of being, so the things that we reveal in our assessment of the truth of beings, and namely the beings as beings. So when we discover the truth of beings, we basically reveal that they are beings, as beings. These things that we unconceal in the truth-seeking process overpower everything. So kind of annihilate or wipe out all other possibilities, because they swallow up even nothingness, incorporating as the not and the over and against. So in a sense, in establishing beings as beings, the nothingness in things is kind of erased, and we don't really relate to it anymore, and we become encapsulated by and entranced by the beingness of beings. And then we take that nothingness, which is in everything and everywhere, but is covered up by the truth-seeking process, and just turn it into a kind of notness or an over and againstness, an opposition, an opposing force or party that, in a sense, is separate from the being. Or they utterly annihilate nothingness, so they just kind of get rid of it, and it doesn't become, it's not considered anymore. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I think what's kind of interesting about this tiny passage is it puts forward the proposal that there is a lot of nothingness out there, and that nothingness is integral to that which we're seeking the truth of. But that nothingness is repressed, rejected, overlooked, and we develop a life full of beings, and beings as beings, and beingness, and that's sort of what Heidegger calls presence or at-handness. And we sort of almost only interact with stuff, and don't have a relationship with nothingness. We fix it into a sort of a logical category of notness, which is a little neutered and bland and in a sense untrue, but that nothingness permeates everything. And part of this machination, liberalism, this metaphysical obsession, representation as reality mindset that we've been talking about, it can be seen now as a fixation on stuffing life with beings that have no nothingness in them, which is, as Heidegger would probably say, not the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But that nothingness is eradicated or annihilated, as he says, through this sort of trick of developing the negative or the not as a logical opposition or an over and againstness. Which shows that logic is, in a sense, not just a tool of thinking or a pattern of thinking. It becomes an actual repository or an enabler of, in a sense, dishonest or untruthful categorizations that demarcate aspects of reality into neutered logical categories.
Mm-hmm.
And we use that logical structure to perpetuate our practice of only relating to beings, or just perpetuate our mindset in a sense, and leave reality in that way. Yeah, I mean, the beingness and nothingness, you know, that's just really classical sort of dialectics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you read Hegel, you're just going to read that nothing, that being is nothingness, and that they are, you know, in each other and of each other and identical and blah, blah, blah. And it's just kind of, I would say, in the liberal, in the machinated liberalism that we live in, that's just kind of forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
So is it like, if you just say not X, like not a vase, then, or not nothingness, or like if it's not bad. So is the idea is that that's really just making another kind of being on top of a being,
yes.
And that we're covering up through logic. We're doing that through logic, and in a way, we're kind of covering up what nothingness actually is.
Yes.
Because of that logic.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think there's that word reification, which is sort of turning everything into things.
Yeah.
The materialization or the realization, not the realization, but the kind of the making present at hand of everything, the thinging of life. Mm-hmm. And yeah, not X is just as much of a thing as X. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of thingness run amok, or thingness constantly replicating itself, as opposed to a thought process or an analytical process or a truth seeking process, that relies less on position and negation and more on the way, in a sense, the dialectic of the way that being and nothingness are each other, our identity and difference interfuse together to make whatever it is that's in front of us. Mm-hmm. But that's what's in front of us, or what we're relating to, or what we're seeking the truth of, is not being as opposed to nothingness. It's being in nothingness, nothingness in being, being as nothingness. You know, how can we bring those two, what seem to be opposed ideas, into one idea of the stuff that we are actually relating to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. The other beginning experiences the truth of being and asks about the being of truth. In order first to ground the essential occurrence of being and to let beings arise as the true of that original truth.
Okay, yeah.
Should I just keep going?
Sure.
In the primordiality of these beginnings, everything conventional is always impossible. Indeed, in very different ways, and the transitional is the genuine battle. Wherever the beginning gives rise to a starting point and to an advancing, there is always the danger that these will come to count as the measure by which the primordial is not only gauged, but also is interpreted.
Yeah. I guess we should do those paragraphs together. Yeah. So he talks about the other beginning, and he juxtaposes it to the first beginning. The other beginning, he says, experiences the truth of being, as opposed to the truth of beings. So that is a distinction. What that distinction is constituted of is a big question. It asks about the being of truth. As opposed to the being of truth, it asks about the being of truth in order first to ground the essential occurrence of being. So it does this to ground the essential occurrence of being and to let beings arise as the true of that original truth. So in a sense, it places beings after the process of seeking the truth of being. The truth of being is the original truth, and beings will arise out of it. So instead of seeking beings and then formulating more beings, what we're in the truth-seeking process, we're seeking the truth of bang, finding that original truth, maybe finding more bang indeed, but beings will arise out of that occurrence. So, you know, again, I would say probably if, you know, there's been a lot of definitions of bang in this book so far, or insinuations of what its essence is, but here it would seem to imply that that in one sense the truth of being could be that sort of amalgam of being and nothingness as it moves dialectically along in the front of us and through us. So being is the being that does not annihilate nothingness. It is not the being that incorporates nothingness as a not and an over and against. It is not the being that overpowers everything or swallows up nothingness. So it actually it contains the nothingness. It conjoins the nothingness. It engages with the nothingness. It is the nothingness. It's the nothingness process. And in interacting with Bang, relating with Bang, as opposed to being, and just propagating more beings, instead of propagating Bang, we're appropriated by Bang. So it's a very different, I would say, almost a philosophical endeavor to experience the truth of Bang versus experiencing the truth of beings. In the primordiality of these beginnings, so that's in the primordiality of the beginnings of the other beginning, as the other beginning is kicking off in its early juvenile phase, everything conventional is always impossible. And the transitional is the genuine battle. So making the transition is the struggle. How the transition occurs, being transitional, it's impossible that you would partake in the conventional because you're engaged in the establishment of the other beginning, and the conventional simply, you can't even engage. Impossible is a great word. It's conceptually, it's experientially, it's in a sense, even ideologically impossible for you. Yeah, go ahead.
Is he saying that's true of both the beginnings?
No.
Or just the other beginning? Okay.
I think just the other beginning. I believe. I don't know why. I mean, I think it's a manner of speaking.
Yeah.
These beginnings, meaning these beginnings that are part of the other beginning. These stirrings, right? These events inherent to the other beginning. Wherever the beginning gives rise to, see, he goes back to the beginning here. So I think, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. Wherever the beginning gives rise to a starting point and to an advancing, which the other beginning does, there is always the danger that these will come. So these, meaning these starting points and these advancing, will come to count as the measure by which the primordial is not only gauged, but also interpreted. Real shop talk here from the philosopher. He's being really subtle and saying that this idea of this beginning, I know that there is inherent in the idea of a beginning, the idea of a starting point and an advancing, but these ideas can be dangerous because we can come to not only gauge the value of, but also interpret the primordiality of these beginnings by how they're advancing, what their starting point is, etc. So we can, and that would be, I would say, kind of first beginning of us and kind of metaphysical of us. These primordial beginnings, they just need to be, they need to occur. We need to wage the battle of transition and not gauge or interpret the beginning, the way we're carrying out the beginning, by how it's starting or where it's going. So in a sense, I don't know. I almost feel like he's saying, just go with it. Right?
Yeah.
I think even more than that, it's like the liberal tendency would be to analyze these primordial beginnings according to where they began and how they're advancing. Yeah. Because the liberal mind is going to be focused on, addicted to, the perpetuation of its metaphysic. And that is indeed super self-destructive if you're looking to wage the battle of the transition and really, really get going on the other beginning. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's related, but there's this thing going on in the CDC today in the news, the Center for Disease Control. By the sound of the press, there's like a civil war going on in the Center for Disease Control. And it's because the Secretary of Health, RFK Jr., you know, has some opinions about vaccines and research and mandates that he wants instituted. And the scientists and the CDC are revolting. Mm. They fired the head of the CDC today because she refused to sort of follow her boss's orders and has spoken out against her boss.
That being RFK Jr.?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so the scientists are really, they're taking a stand and saying, this is unacceptable that we're being fired, that we're being told what to do, that our scientific integrity is being compromised by this democratic process or whatever, or the fascism, however they think of it. And what's interesting is, you could almost call RFK Jr. an other beginning of some kind, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. A democratically elected other beginning, by the way. Calling it fascism is obviously absurd because he's a democratically elected official. Yeah. But the primordiality of this transition that he's trying to institute, right, which is totally justified within the system that he's working in, is being looked at by the establishment, who think that they're above the democracy, above that their first beginning takes precedence over the other beginning. And what they're really taking objection to is the starting point and the advancement of his other beginning. Mm. And they're interpreting and gauging that primordiality according to where it started and where it's going. It started with Trump and it's going to God knows where. And they're not letting it happen. Mm-hmm. So what Heidegger is saying here is we have to let it happen. Mm-hmm. We have to let the other beginning happen. And its primordiality is going to possibly look really absurd compared to the advanced multi-century, developments of the first beginning, the established cathedral-esque beginning. Mm-hmm. But the transition is the battle. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. So I found that interesting. I mean,
I had an unrelated thought about that today because we were just looking at the dosage for our daughter's cold medicine, and the doctor always gives us printout and it says a lot of stuff. And one of the things it says is flu vaccines are recommended every year, and then COVID vaccines are recommended every year. And it was like the exact same wording for both. And then I was like, I thought actually COVID wasn't recommended for children now, but that's a whole nother point. But it just made me do a double take on the fact that I take everything written in that pamphlet as like pretty much like true. But then you come into some things and I think COVID opened up a lot of, alternative or conspiracy theory takes on the use of vaccines. So I'm just like kind of curious about like what is
what's going on there?
Yeah.
I mean, it's chaos right now, I would say. And it's chaos because the scientific establishment believes it's above democracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
That it has a loyalty to a higher calling. Be that truth or scientific validity.
Well, they would definitely say truth, yes.
Yeah, or health or the health of the nation. And, what I would say is that, it's not that any other beginning should be allowed, right? Like if the other beginning was that RFK Jr. was going to line up all the scientists against the wall and shoot them in the head with a golden bullet, that's not part of the system. That's not part of like the whole arrangement. Mm-hmm. Within the arrangement that these people are working in called democracy, their claim of being above the orders of their democratically elected boss is, if there's any fascism in the room, it's them.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're claiming, I'm sure,
if they would, yeah, I
mean, an independent truth,
exactly,
or an what do you call it, an objective truth,
yeah, exactly, which is what the deep state is doing,
right,
ad nauseum,
right.
But you know, as Curtis Yarvin says, either democracy is total or it's a farce.
Yeah. Right.
And that's absolutely true. Like, there's no part of the government that should not be answerable to the democratic process.
Yeah.
Or else, or if that's the case, then democracy is false.
Yeah.
So yeah, a little politics there, but let's read on, huh?
Yeah. Proceeding from the first, okay, let me just say, so I feel like, I mean, there was this whole section earlier in the book about science where we went into it very in depth, but, and maybe we did talk about this then, but it's like science is also another version of the deep state.
Oh yeah.
Which I'm sure we said at some point, but like, it's just kind of amazing the ways to which we take it as objective, but it's very skewed towards one political party.
Oh, absolutely.
Anyways.
What's that line from Ron Silliman? Dance is a funding.
Do you remember, oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Something like dance is just good crowdfunding or something.
Dance.
That's a really good
line. I mean, essentially, dance is funding.
Yeah, right.
Basically,
yeah.
That's the line from one of his poems or something like that. And science is just funding.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay, great. So why don't we keep reading?
Proceeding from the first beginning, the thought starts. I'll start over. Proceeding from the first beginning, thought starts to entrench itself in the form of the question, what are beings? That is the guiding question, which is the starting point of Western metaphysics. This question is posed at first tacitly and then explicitly. It would be mistaken, however, to suppose that the guiding question could be encountered in the first beginning and as the beginning. Only for the sake of a rough first instruction can the guiding question help to characterize the first beginning in its way of thought. Should I keep going?
Yeah, I think it's fun. He's kind of like, you know, basically the first beginning is about asking what are beings, but you're not going to find that in the first beginning because in a sense, that's my analysis of what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
That's my analysis of what is its underlying impetus. It's MO is that guiding question. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
On the other hand, as soon as the guiding question becomes the measure for thinking, the primordiality of the beginning gets lost as well. I.e. it draws back into what is ungrounded about the beginning.
Yeah, but it seems like he's talking about the first beginning there, right? On the other hand, as soon as the guiding question becomes the measure for thinking, so as soon as what is being becomes the measure for thinking, so you're only thinking if you're asking what is being, and that's a mandate or a dictum of the first beginning. The primordiality of the beginning gets lost as well. So the kind of origins of the beginning, how the beginning really began, and it draws back into what is ungrounded about it. So it, we just kind of lose its basis. Yeah.
If we actually seek the history of philosophy in the occurrence and first beginning of thinking, and if we hold open this thinking in its historicality by developing the guiding question, which has been undeveloped throughout this entire history up to Nietzsche, then the inner movement of this thinking can be seized, although only formally by means of single steps and stages. The experience, apprehension, and gathering of beings in their truth are concretized in the question of the beingness of beings under the guideline and the anticipatory grasp provided by thinking, apprehensional assertion.
Fun. That's a fun little parenthesis there.
Yeah, right?
Apprehensional assertion is what thinking is.
Yeah.
If we seek the history of philosophy in the occurrence and first beginning of thinking. So we're looking for the history of philosophy in the occurrence of thinking and the way thinking started, what thinking is, how thinking is carried out, what thinking's objects are, what thinking is seeking. And if we hold open this thinking in its historicality, so we hold it open as a historical series of events by developing the guiding questions. So, looking at the guiding question, which again I always forget, which is what are beings, develop that question. So what are beings? And start asking what are beings and really take that question seriously. Which ironically, this guiding question has been undeveloped throughout the entire history up to Nietzsche. Then the inner movement of this thinking can be seized. So we would literally kind of come to understand what the inner engine of this thinking is by developing the guiding question, what are beings? Although only formally by means of single steps and stages. Those single steps and stages, there's a colon here, right? Mm-hmm. The experience, apprehension, and gathering of beings in their truth are concretized in the question of the beingness of beings under the guideline and anticipatory grasp provided by thinking. I'm not sure how that follows a colon in mm-hmm. that sentence, although only formally by means of single steps and stages.
Maybe that's what he's saying the guiding question reveals.
Yeah, that's interesting.
If you develop the guiding question?
If we actually seek the history of philosophy of the curse, and if we hold open this thinking in its historicality about developing the guiding question, which has been developed throughout since Nietzsche, then the inner movement of this thinking can be seized. Okay, you're right. Here, then, we hear the inner movement of this thinking. Mm-hmm. The inner movement of thinking as developed or as it has occurred from the first beginning is this. The experience, apprehension, and gathering of beings in their truth are concretized. So the experience, apprehension, and gathering of beings are concretized, so reified, made material in the question of the beingness of beings. So we ask about the beingness of beings under the guideline and anticipatory grasp provided by thinking. Fantastic, right? So mm-hmm. essentially we're seeking the essence of things. So thinking has become the quest for the essence of things according to the guidelines and anticipatory grasp that thinking is based on. And this process of experience, apprehension, and gathering, right, of beings, mm-hmm. is concretized. Mm-hmm. So it becomes bulk, it becomes matter, it becomes stuff, mm-hmm. it becomes a system, it becomes obstacles and ponderances. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so, you know, we're stuck in the middle there. We're stuck with these architectural structures of concretized experience, concretized apprehension, concretized gathering of beings in their truth. We're following the guidelines and anticipatory grasp provided by thinking, apprehensional assertion, mm-hmm. right? Apprehensional assertion. You know, remember when we think, we always assert something. Mm-hmm. We apprehend, we assert, None of which, you know, really, do we have to do that? Why does thinking have to be that?
Yeah.
I mean, this little paragraph, the experience, apprehension, and gathering of beings in their truth. I mean, that's the mindset that creates anxiety right there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, apprehension isn't that basically anticipatory anxiety
exactly. Yeah. Apprehension has a fear element to it. Yeah.
I wonder what the German word is.
Yeah, so the German is actually Vernehmendes, from Vernehmen, which means to hear or to sort of take in or understand or learn or question or examine. It doesn't seem to really have the fear element inherent in the English word apprehension.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, this paragraph to me feels very much like the stage on which anxiety's performance is night after night, given rave reviews by the liberal.
And talk
liberal
more about
masses.
Why?
Huh?
Talk more about why that is. I'd like thinking as apprehensional assertion. There's a guideline and. Well, anticipatory grasp provided by thinking.
Yeah.
In a way, it's like thinking as a being claim, right?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of
That's
the
right
topic.
It is.
So it's like making a being.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as you said, there's this theme of it, thinking being an assertion, a correctness claim.
Yeah.
And so it gives it, being, I guess.
Yeah.
And all of that is not, I don't know. It's not necessarily
how things
thinking, how things need to be, or thinking's power to, thinking's power to give.
Yeah.
Actually, what thinking should be able to have power over.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're totally right. Spot on there. I mean, I think in general, the sentence seems to be implying that thinking, that the form that thinking has taken, or the process of thinking, since this first beginning, is one that is, habitual, concretizing, guided, anticipatory. So it's very locked. It feels very unfree to me.
Mm-hmm.
It feels very patterned and like it's following a modality.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when experience becomes concretized, that means that, you know, that means that we're stuck in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a real, heavy, impenetrable object that is us, or that we must muck our way through.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a fluid, free, open, you know, questionable, nothingness imbued event. It's been concretized.
Mm-hmm.
Apprehension becomes concretized. So
mm-hmm.
observing, learning, hearing, seeing, and again, when we say concretize, what we mean is it becomes, it has rules, it has patterns, mm-hmm. it has structures, it has investments, it has funding, it has force, it has tradition, what he calls up here, it becomes a convention,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And the gathering of beings in their truth. So we gather beings as true.
Mm-hmm.
We're the scientists of the CDC, and we have gathered the beings in their truth. And when somebody comes and tries to get rid of those things, they're literally taking a jackhammer to the concrete of our existence, or more importantly, of our thought,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're blowing the guidelines out of the water, and they're taking our anticipatory grasp, and they're dismantling it, and now we don't know what to think.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what to do. We're too free. We're dismantled. Our foundation is gone. They've jackhammered all our concrete, and now we have no foundation, right? Mm-hmm. So the whole thing feels like a real format. Mm-hmm. Thinking as format. Mm-hmm. So then, why is that anxiety? Well, you know, I mean, I would kind of say that, you know, that maybe there's a traditional view of anxiety as being, it's sort of the cliche Camus existentialist view of anxiety is that, you know, man is free in the face of existence, mm-hmm. and that freedom is anxiety inducing. Heidegger's kind of saying the exact opposite, is that that humanity has let itself be formalized into an apprehensional assertion called thinking that concretizes everything because it's addicted to gathering beings in their truth. And basically thought has become saying that beings are beings and making more beings for there to be beings about and of. Mm-hmm. It's that automation of our very freedom that is actually anxiety inducing. Because I think we actually want to be free, or actually we realize that we need to be free.
Yeah.
To operate, to make decisions, to triumph, to survive.
Yeah.
But there's all this automation in how we approach reality that is limiting that freedom, and that makes us anxious because that threatens our survival. Mm-hmm. And anxiety is not something you do to yourself. Mm-hmm. You don't wake up in the morning and say, I think I'll be anxious. Mm-hmm. It just happens to you. Mm-hmm. It's a symptom mm-hmm. of the automation of thinking. Mm-hmm. It's a symptom of the way the first beginning has set us up mm-hmm. to have experiences, apprehensions, and gatherings of beings in their truth that continually turn into concrete. Mm-hmm. Right. We're not just floating down a river anymore. We're like our foot is stuck in 3 feet of concrete mm-hmm. every time. And that's anxiety inducing because you can't move. Mm-hmm. You're stuck with everything.
Yeah. Well said.
And just, you know, we use thought to try to get out of anxiety.
Yeah.
You listen to all these podcasts, you read all these books, you do a podcast about Heidegger, you're thinking, how can I get out of anxiety? Well, it's thought that puts you into anxiety.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
You're literally asking, how can I fall more to get out of the hole I've fallen into?
Well, he does have thinking here in quotes.
Right.
So I do think there's a general idea that there's a different kind of thinking possible.
That's right.
But it's obviously
beginning is about.
Yeah, it's very,
It's very what?
It's just tempered by the challenges of using thought itself.
Yeah. But what else it's do we tempered use? By 2,500 years of being, you know, raised. Mm-hmm. It's just like we are raised in this culture and we're able to only think in the ways that the culture has taught us to think. We have glimpses of thinking outside that pattern, but it's hard to get there. Mm-hmm. Hard to get there mm-hmm. because everything has become concretized. And essentially, we've been put into concrete boots and thrown into the river. Mm-hmm. So it's hard.
Yeah, I really like that. I know you've said it before, but that idea that anxiety is a symptom of this thought tradition makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And I also like pointing out that, cause I think that is a really common, the idea is like, oh, there are just so many options as humans, like we could do anything. We're totally free. So what do? We have so much volition, choice. Sort of in the infinite possibilities. So how do we know what to do?
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of, we've talked about the infinite possibilities as bound up in the first beginning too. Um, but I like, I don't know. So maybe there's something there, but I do like how you kind of are putting this as sort of the flip of that.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if we could say something to wrap up, like, you know, in the way that we think about anxiety, or rather I would say in the way that anxiety is supposedly being treated.
Yeah.
By treated, I mean like the way the professionals are advising us to escape anxiety.
Yeah.
I'm continually fascinated by how Heidegger can flip that all on its head.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, in a conspiratorial way, show that the professionals are actually the cause of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Or their thought patterns that they're using and propagating via their liberationist diatribes are actually the very ones that prevent the liberation they're encouraging us to.
Yeah.
Which again is very fundable and very profitable.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not forget that. But you know, totally. How does this stuff put anxiety? You've read all the literature. How does it put that all on its head? Flip it all on its head. I mean, go ahead.
Well, I just think right away about, cause like one of the biggest mantras is like to be okay with uncertainty.
Yeah.
So that's like a very big mantra. Another big mantra is to accept where you're at.
Absolutely. Good idea.
And that's all I can think of right now.
So, I mean, those seem like good ideas.
Right? Yeah. You're like, yeah.
But I mean, are they good ideas?
I don't know.
Do they work at all?
I mean, they haven't really worked for me, no.
Yeah. I mean, they don't work.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they do for some people, but would be Heidegger's take, or what would be the,
I don't know. This is a paltry metaphor, but I just feel like, so like the whole anxiety regime right now is really about saying, you know, I don't know. It's the difference between like makeup and surgery in a sense, you know, not plastic surgery, but I don't know. There's something about, you know, the way that
it's like a superficial.
Yeah, fix, exactly.
And
I mean, I think what we're trying to do in here is we're trying to deconstruct and dive into and do surgery on the very most basic thought patterns that have brought us to this point, that have brought us to the age of anxiety, as the great flowering of liberalism, that liberalism's great triumph is that everyone is anxious so that they can be more liberal. Like that's liberalism's crown.
Mm-hmm.
It's figured out how to set fires
in
everyone's brain so that everyone gives everything they have to the fireman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like they've just got that down.
Yeah.
And you know, so the point is to stop setting fires in the brain so you don't need the liberals.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is to stop the loop.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're trying to do here is just try to really get under the hood of how liberalism
thinks. Do the transition.
Exactly.
The transition.
Exactly. The transition.
He had a good word about like opening up the.
Yeah. And, you know, take the CDC example, you know, it's like the scientists that are appalled by what's going on. It's like, you know, the transition might be a little sloppy.
Yeah.
But it's your aversion to there being any sloppiness that you've turned into a kind of scientific religion. You know, you're free to like quit your government job and not be an employee of the democracy and go start something that advocates for whatever you want to advocate for. You know what I mean? But when you're in the democracy vessel, to complain that the vessel is flying along a trajectory of democracy, and refuse to get out and use every lawyer in your power to prevent from being thrown out, then you're a parasite.
Yeah. I mean, I feel, sorry.
And I would say that those people are just symbols of the concretized experiences and thoughts that we cling to because we depend on them and we think that they're going to give us the safety we need. But the fact is, they're not working democratically. Like mm-hmm. they're a problem in the system. Mm-hmm. And I think inevitably what we want is pure democracy. And I mean, and I think even in the mind, we want pure democracy mm-hmm. of the mind, mm-hmm. but we have all these entrenched lifers, bureaucratic lifers mm-hmm. who've turned their cause celebre into a battle cry. And they're willing to just kind of like spit in the face of the whole damn thing in order to stand up for truth. And it's just embarrassing.
Yeah, I really like right now, just I feel like really able to take like kind of any claim, like about vaccines, or there's some, I don't know, they're just like any sort of claim, and just be like, well, does that make sense? Like if we just pull it out of politics, like does, yeah. you know, does it make sense? And just to question all the things that we've taken as mantra
yeah.
for so long.
Yeah.
I like that. And I feel like really able to do that kind of on both sides, to both sides.
Right.
Like it used to really upset me when like the side I was on said something I didn't like.
Right.
But in just kind of listening to more different podcasts and stuff, I feel a little more able to be like, okay, well, yeah, I definitely don't agree, but like, but that's okay. They can say that.
At least you're trying to think outside the box.
Yeah. 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 And yes.
And they can say that. Yeah. Of course.
They're allowed
they can
to say that. Yeah. And I'm allowed exactly. to not agree. So that's fine.
Exactly.
But it's funny because I feel like I can really take that approach when it comes to that, but then it's still like when it comes to anxiety or intrusive thoughts, it's like if there's something I don't like, I'm like
yeah,
no, you can't do that.
Yeah, right. Well, that's liberalism.
Which is liberal. Yeah.
Yeah. Let your intrusive just, thoughts speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let them live.
Yeah.
You know, let them live. We're all yeah. Republicans here, you know. Like some Republicans have crazy fucking ideas, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Some Republicans are obnoxious and awful.
Yeah.
But like, you know, freedom of speech, man.
Yeah,
you know
yeah. what I mean? Freedom of speech, yeah, that's true.
Slightly related here, really quick. So, I don't know, I mentioned last time about my mother, right? And we've mm-hmm. been talking largely only about my mother for like a week yeah. now. What yeah. to do about her. She has dementia, but she won't admit it. She's a danger to herself, but she won't admit it. I want to try to get her to come live in the house, my house, my guest house, not live alone. She won't do it, but yet she says it's her wish. You know, it's just this, it's just very awful. And, but you know, so by way of full disclosure, if she comes and lives here, And I can, you know, I can build her own little place on the land, et cetera. Like, I get some of her money.
You think, anyways, at this point.
I think.
You
I
would mean, think.
Well, if she's going to live here, then some of her money is going to go to me
yeah.
so that I can pay to have somebody visit her, you know, so I can pay for her food. So, you know, I mean, yeah. I'm going to kind of come in, you know, and I'm going to kind of start making a little money taking care of my mom in a much safer way. And I've been wondering, oh, so... I've been feeling super liberal because,
yeah, yeah.
because liberalism, because I've just become a fierce advocate for my mother needing to move in here. but mindful all the time that there's a little bit of a financial motive there. And I've had to ask myself, have I only become vehement about this issue of my mother moving in with me because I stand to gain financially from it? Because that would be really liberal of me. And mm-hmm. I've been watching liberals in the media and it's just like, I just like I see now mm-hmm. how their vehemence and their advocacy and their rage is all this weird sublimated personality that they've adopted because their financial
livelihood is at stake.
That and, yeah. and it's like nothing gets you more vehement than that.
Yeah.
And I see it in them.
Yeah.
And their money is being taken away.
Yeah.
But yet they're channeling it through all this righteousness
yeah.
and compassion and ideology. But yeah. really, they're just really freaking out because their money is slipping mm-hmm. away.
Yeah.
So I've had to ask myself, am I just doing this to my mom because the money is there? Mm-hmm. And the answer is no.
Yeah.
Well, what I've done to assure that's not the case is I've called my brother and my mother's best friend and the doctor, and I've said, my instinct is that it's time for my mother to move in with me. I don't say, and I stand to financially gain from that, but that's my instinct.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah.
Now, if they'd all said, no, Kirk, come on.
Yeah.
It's too early. Like, you don't need to do that. Then I'd be like, oh, geez.
No, what are the, they're like, I'm you're the last one to realize
exactly.
this.
Exactly. They're all like, actually, we've been telling you that for
years. You just haven't really heard it.
You haven't wanted to hear it. So
they say that? I believe that.
No, I mean,
it's implied.
You know, they've all been like, it's time, Kirk.
Yeah.
To a T, to a person, they've said it's time.
Yes, it's time.
So I've let the idea that I'm doing it for the money go.
Yeah.
And that I'm actually doing it for her own good.
Yeah.
The money is a little bit of a thing, but I'm doing it for her own good. But before I had kind of gotten confirmation of that, I really clocked into the liberal, the liberal way. And it's, I mean, I've been fighting with her for 2 weeks. You need to move, Mom. You're a danger to yourself. I've been saying all these things like, you're a danger to yourself and others. It's so liberal. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, and I could make some money if you move in with me. But it's like, so I just saw it. And it's really like, once you see it, once you see that in liberalism, once you see that,
that's a really interesting
sincerity based in funding.
Yeah.
It's so cringe and so nauseating and so corrupt, and you just can't believe that they're engaging in it without any sense of...
Totally. Even us just using those phrases around the house, it's like a little... Like, I start to feel a little uncomfortable because it's just kind of weird. And you're talking about, you know, there's the adult protective services threat and hospitalization threat, and all that stuff is very kind of scary. And it actually... Just running up into that is like... kind of scary.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that has any, but it feels like you're going into the system.
And I'm going into systematic thinking.
Yeah.
Because the interesting thing is, in a sense, the ultimate non-liberal thing to do would be to say, my mom's free to do whatever she wants. And eventually she's just going to fall down the stairs and die, but that's what she wants.
Yeah.
Like, who am I to step in and prevent her from doing that?
Because she has expressed that she doesn't
see
want
that. And that's the problem. Is like, you know, I don't think it's necessarily like my true, like, and this is the way she raised me. My true belief is that, you know, it's like, yeah, my mom wants to die fighting tigers. So let her die fighting tigers.
Yeah.
Who am I to pull the tigers out of her life?
Yeah.
But she has dementia. So I'm not sure she's totally in her right wits.
She's not.
Well, I'm quite sure she's not at all in any of her wits, but she has said to me repeatedly for 10 years, I want to live with you when I get too old.
Yeah.
And she's about to mess that up.
Yeah.
So I'm actually looking out for her interest.
Yeah.
Which I think is what I should be doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you're carrying out what she has expressed when she's,
which she's unable
when
to
she
realize
had her
now.
Thoughts, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah.
So I'm not liberal. I'm not being liberal. I'm just being greedy.
Well, I think I don't know. I still think there's like something about the power of the system that's like scary, but I'm not sure it's really relevant.
Well,
I'm thinking about it because I had a friend who tried to kill herself and I took her to the hospital, and I was actually in there in the hospital with her, and it's a containment room, and it's like, who is, because she was drinking, you know, so it was intense. It was very, and like, I still don't know if I've recovered from that experience.
Yeah, I like, think that's right. I mean,
you know,
like,
so there's like that whole thing that's just really kind of.
Yeah. And I'm very mindful of, like, you know, in every possible way I can, I want to keep her away from hospitals and doctors, because you can get into some serious trouble if you go that route, because they can detain you and force you to do against your will because they see something.
Yeah.
You know? And so, I mean, she needs care and she needs to see doctors and stuff, but like, if at all possible, keep her away from that stuff, because...
But I'm wondering more about, like, where that fits into the liberal... It's like the power of liberalism.
Yeah, I mean, you mean the institutions?
Or is it the power of health? I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think that's an interesting point because I think we're in the middle right now of a real rejiggering of that question. You know, yeah. I think that post-COVID, people said, you know what? The medical establishment, in bed with the media establishment, in bed with the universities, in bed with all the scientists, in bed with all the liberal politicians, in bed with all of that, they all really proved, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that when they want to, they will basically take over society.
Yeah.
For the purposes of manifesting their care plan for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, none of us, you know, we didn't ask for the care plan. They forced the care plan on us.
Mm-hmm.
We all went to the hospital and the doctor said, actually, you're going to do A, B, and C, not because you want to, but just because we're going to tell you to, to protect X, Y, and Z and shut up. And if you don't, you know, agree, you're going to lose your job and your kids can't go to school and blah, blah, blah. Like we saw it happen.
Yeah.
And so now there's a boomeranging. What is it? Pendulum swing.
In
the other direction. And people are trying to say, you know, there's got to be a little more freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not like, you know, we don't want a world in which anytime something happens that the institution believes it can profit off of by basically shutting our whole world down, that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like we want a little say.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of a swing there. And I think that's real. And, you know, that's the other beginning. That's been part of the interesting.
Or a transition.
Yeah, it's a transition. And that's a little part of the interesting of the reading tonight is like this first beginning, other beginning, this transition, this truth of beings, this truth of bang is always occurring in all these little micro social ways and all these little psychological ways in relationships, in your mind, in politics, in society. It's like this transition that he talks about is going on micro and macro.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, did you hear Elon Musk is founding a software company called Macro Hard to counter Microsoft?
No, that's hilarious. I didn't even realize that.
He's running a company called Macro Hard.
That's hilarious.
Anyhow.
Or he should have like banana.
Yeah, right. All right, I guess that's it.
Yeah.
Right? I think that's it.
Yeah, totally.
I think we came around to macro hard.
Yeah, great.
So out of the first beginning of Microsoft, you have the other beginning of macro hard.
Well, I think the point is, though, is that we don't yet know what the other beginning is, really. So it's not macro hard, necessarily.
That's right.
But maybe that's why we should be okay with uncertainty. But I still hate that phrase so much. You were supposed to like debunk that phrase. Sorry.
Oh, be okay with uncertainties.
Yeah.
That phrase is so easily debunked. First of all, to be okay with uncertainty means that you believe in certainty.
Yeah.
And that you're supposed to just kind of like, you know.
Right.
Because uncertainty is the opposite of certainty, and you know. Okay with uncertainty
means you believe
like,
in certainty.
Yeah, well, meaning like, you know, every day from like 5 to 6, uncertainty comes around and I'm totally cool with him.
Yeah.
You know, he's a little crazy and he burns down all my art and, you know, eats my trees, but, you know, hey, I'm cool with him, you know, but by and large, other than that hour, I need certainty, you know?
Uh-huh.
And just like saying that there's certainty and uncertainty, like, really? Have you really crunched the numbers? Have you really looked at the map? Have you really charted out how your life has gone? What has been certain? What has been uncertain? Just viewing life vis-a-vis this binary of certainty and uncertainty is just really silly.
Yeah. Well, I think, I feel like you said it very well, that in order to be okay with uncertainty, you have to believe in certainty. So you have to believe there is certainty, and that's sort of like the being and the not being.
Yeah, exactly.
And this
whole thing of like, be okay with it. I mean, that's just so like, I'm okay with that guy, but you know, it's really snarky and really passive aggressive.
Yeah.
It's not really being okay.
Yeah.
You've got to be okay with it. Meaning like swallow your words, bite your teeth,
Right. Let it sit there and accept molest it. Your children.
Yeah.
But don't fight it.
Yeah.
And it's like, no. Or how about like, no, I'm not okay with uncertainty. I'm not okay with certainty either. I'm not even okay with people telling me what's certain and what's uncertain. Yeah. I'm not even okay with like looking at the world vis-a-vis the filter of certainty or uncertainty. Mm-hmm. I'm also not okay with like being told what I should be okay with. Mm-hmm. I'm not even okay with being okay. Or actually, I don't want to be okay or not okay with anything. Mm-hmm. I just want to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it sets up that whole thing of like, there's things you should be okay with and there's things you shouldn't be okay with. I mean, of course that happens.
Yeah.
But what does that have to do with anxiety? Like, that's actually just called war.
It's always done in the context of you worry something terrible is going to happen. And then you are like, okay, well, the likelihood of that happening is actually very low. Like it's like 1/1,000,000% or something.
It's so stupidly low, it doesn't exist. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Right. And right. That's the other, it doesn't actually exist. So, but the idea is that you have to be okay with the fact that there is a tiny possibility it might happen.
And see, that's the other thing. It's like, so the uncertainty, you know,
actually being okay with, something bad possibly happening. And then it's like, well, what if you're not okay with that?
See, that credits the idea that it might happen.
Yes, it does.
Which is stupid.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a place at which, you know, statistics turns into nonsense.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I mean, the idea that, so say, you know, there's a knife on the counter and you might take it, pick it up and stab yourself or stab your family, right?
Yeah.
It's uncertain that you might do that or not. No, it's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not uncertain.
Yeah. That was like blasphemy.
What I just said?
Yeah, kind of. I was just like, oh my God, he said
the devil. All right.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah,
it's late.
Yeah.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Choya podcast. For more information, visit leapingchoya.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.